This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a potential war crimes investigation into the Kunduz hospital airstrike. Rough seas cut migrant flow to Greece. A sketch artist helps catch criminals.
I turned it around, and the four-year-old got real mad, and he said, "Why did you draw a picture of that man? That means it looked like him." And everybody in the room started crying.
A new movie takes a controversial look at Steve Jobs, the late co-founder of tech giant Apple. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Obama apologized in a telephone call Wednesday to the head of the medical charity Doctors Without Borders for the U.S. bombing October 3rd of its hospital in the embattled northern Afghan city of Kunduz that killed 22 patients and staff. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says Mr. Obama is very eager to get to the bottom of what exactly occurred. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders is calling for an independent panel to conduct an investigation under the Geneva Conventions. Lisa Schlein reports.
The commission was established in 1991 under the Geneva Conventions. It is the only permanent body whose goal specifically is to investigate violations of international humanitarian law, but it has never been used. Joanne Liu, the international president of Doctors Without Borders, says it is time to activate this fact-finding tool.
The facts and circumstances of this attack must be investigated independently and impartially, particularly given the inconsistency in the U.S. and Afghan accounts of what happened over the recent days. We cannot rely on internal military investigation by the U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces.
She says letters were sent Tuesday to the 76 signatory countries of the commission to sponsor an inquiry. She says the assent of only one country is needed, and United States and Afghan governments must give their consent to trigger the probe. Liu says the commission's role is only to establish and clarify facts. She says it is not a legal body and cannot determine whether a war crime has been committed. She calls this a preliminary investigation and a much longer process. Liu says the space in which humanitarians can operate in war zones is under threat. She says it will not be possible for Doctors Without Borders and other medical workers to continue their activities in countries such as Syria, South Sudan, and Yemen if they are not safeguarded.
If we let this go, this as if, you know, it was a non-event, we're basically giving a blank check to any countries who are at war in conflict and telling them, you know what, you can do whatever, because actually nothing, you know, is happening. You're not being, accountable for anything.
Liu says it is essential to uphold the rules of law in the Geneva Conventions. She notes attacking hospitals and medical facilities can constitute a war crime under international humanitarian law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, Army General John Campbell, says the United States is taking the blame for carrying out last Saturday's raid after Afghan forces requested it to attack Taliban insurgents it believed were firing from inside the medical facility. But the question remains whether the U.S. should have agreed to the attack. The White House says the future U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan will depend on a variety of factors, including conditions on the ground, the progress made in security, and the threats that remain. Christopher Sneddon, a professor at the Hawaii-based Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, it is quite possible President Obama will keep U.S. troop levels above the envisioned 1,000 at the end of next year.
Now, there's supposedly still about 13,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan from roughly 40-odd nations in this Resolute Support mission, which has taken over from the International Security Assistance Force. And President Obama is contemplating keeping more Americans or perhaps even increasing that number. So that is a reflection of the instability that's currently in Afghanistan.
Doctors Without Borders is calling the attack on its hospital a war crime. Is that going to pose a problem for the U.S.?
Yes, it will be a challenge, I think, in terms of their relationship with Doctors Without Frontiers, that's for sure. hard to justify it as a war crime, I think. I'm not a lawyer, but I think the lawyers would be able to argue that this is a war zone and that they were, to some extent or another anyway, defending them and their interests.
Christopher, the situation in Kunduz, the fact that the Taliban was able to occupy that northeast city for a period of days, points up the real security problems that the Afghan National Forces face.
They do. It's a big job, and Afghanistan is incredibly unstable. And there's a lot of politics as well. Dr. Ghani and Dr. Abdullah aren't necessarily pulling together at the same time in the same way. There is a bright spot, though. The Afghan economy apparently is growing at about 3.1%, which is better than previous years, and suggests that maybe they're getting one or two things right. But there's some serious unrest there. The Taliban has finally resolved its leadership issues with the death of Mullah Omar finally being acknowledged, and Mullah Mansour now apparently in charge. They're a bit more unified, and that's going to only create further problems. There's some serious, what we call warlords, or people with local power, who are sitting on the fence waiting to see which way the wind blows. But there's a lot of political instability in that nation.
How likely do you think it is that the U.S. will have to have a residual force larger than the planned 1,000 by the end of 2016?
It depends how serious they are about allowing the Afghan National Army to defend the nation, keeping Dr. Ghani and his colleagues in power, and also ensuring that the Taliban doesn't get a hold. If they want to do one or both or all of those three things, then they're going to have some forces there, because the Afghan National Army is an army. It doesn't have any air power, or it has limited air power. It has limited abilities to maintain the equipment that it's already been given or that's been left behind by ISAF. So it does need foreign assistance to do some of those basic sort of counter-terrorist type operations. That's not to say that they're not brave and they're not skilled, but they do need that external support, particularly in terms of things like bringing in airstrikes, and it's really only the foreign forces that can provide that. So you need a certain number of people both to offer that assistance and to protect yourself. So perhaps they're going to need more U.S. forces there.
The Washington Post says the Obama administration is studying plans to maintain up to 5,000 troops into 2017. While it says General Campbell has offered several options to the White House that could result in a residual force of 7,000 beyond 2016. Turning to Twitter, we check now with our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee about reaction to President Obama's apology to Doctors Without Borders. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
Did President Obama or the White House tweet about the apology?
Not at all. President Obama's last tweet was from a week ago and about gun control. The White House tweeted a lot Wednesday, but they're all about the Workers' Voice Summit, where Mr. Obama was speaking about unions, insurance, and pay, and that sort of things. But Joanne Liu, who is the international president of Doctors Without Borders, has been tweeting a lot this week, and she was very vocal.
She indeed has been very much in the news the last 24 to 48 hours. What's her Twitter handle, and what's she tweeting?
She's on Twitter at JoanneLiu_MSF, after the organization's French acronym. Now, before hearing from President Obama, she tweeted this: "We need answers not just for MSF, but all medical and humanitarian staff helping victims of conflict everywhere. Hashtag independent investigation." That tweet has been retweeted almost 200 times.
I see. And what about after hearing from the president?
Well, she didn't send out any original tweets or shared any tweets since then, but the content of her statement is making the rounds on the internet. Liu said earlier Wednesday that the airstrike is not just an attack on their hospital, but it was an attack on the Geneva Conventions, which is a series of UN treaties on the treatment of civilians, POWs, and soldiers. And CNN turned that quote into a meme, which is quite popular on Twitter now.
Well, this story seems to be getting bigger and bigger. What other tweets can we follow for updates on the issue?
Well, their main account is at MSF, but if you want live tweets from the organization, there's also at MSF_field. There are many other accounts for the regional offices, so you can get more tailored information that way. And I want to add that the main account is using hashtag independent investigation in all of their tweets. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande have called for unity across Europe to address a series of crises facing the continent. In their speeches to the European Parliament Wednesday in Strasbourg, both leaders said that more cooperation was needed to settle tens of thousands of migrants and refugees arriving in the 28-member bloc. Meanwhile, the European Union started a new operation in the southern Mediterranean Sea Wednesday to intercept human trafficking boats trying to enter the bloc illegally. Operation Sophia began with naval vessels given permission to board, search, and seize vessels suspected of human trafficking. In the past, the EU has focused on search and rescue operations, but with this year's overwhelming flood of migrants from Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere, thousands have ended up dying at sea while trying to reach European shores. More migrants are continuing to arrive in Greece and the EU from Turkey. VOA's Jeff Swikord reports from the Greek island of Lesbos, where rough seas have deterred some, but not all, from making the dangerous journey in small boats.
Thank you, Europa. Thank you.
New arrivals on the Greek island of Lesbos after a rough boat ride from the Turkish mainland.
Very bad. Very bad.
Patrick Mansour is UNHCR's chief of mission in Lesbos. Mansour says rougher winter waves are stopping some migrants from making the crossing, but some still attempt the dangerous journey. And he worries cheaply made smugglers' boats won't survive the 3-kilometer trip from Turkey.
Like it's made for lakes and rivers, like still water. It's not made for sea.
These boats can hold 8 to 10 people. The smugglers pack them with up to 60 migrants, each one paying as much as $1,500. It's a one-way trip for the migrants, boats, and small 15 to 20 horsepower engine. The smugglers do not come along. They designate a driver, point out a direction, and send them on their way.
And if an engine fails, they can drift. I mean, sometimes they're supposed to come a bit northeast from here, but they arrive towards the airport area.
Amar Ghazmati from Damascus, Syria, says some of the smugglers are overloading the boats at gunpoint.
When the people don't want to get in the boat, they force them by the gun. That happened last night with a group of people. The boat stopped in the water, and the Coast Guard helped them.
Lesbos is a quick stop for the migrants. The people at this registration camp near Kara Tepe, outside the port city of Mytilene, said they only had been there for a day. They rest, then pack into cabs and ride into town. There they buy ferry tickets to Athens. Osama, an electrical engineer from Baghdad, said he was excited to continue his journey.
We got our documents and we're going to move now. Actually, at the beginning, to Germany. We will check our plan.
UNHCR officials stress that the decline in numbers of migrants is temporary. They say if there's an improvement in sea conditions, the numbers will rise again. Jeff Swikord, VOA News, Mytilene, Greece.
Reports say more than 130,000 migrants have crossed to Europe from the North African coast this year, but 2,700 of those are believed to have drowned while making the dangerous journey. In business news, investors have pushed U.S. financial markets up, but concerns about China remain as companies with significant ties to the world's second-largest economy begin to report their quarterly earnings. VOA's Alexis Christophers joins us from our New York bureau to help sort out the trends. Alexis?
U.S. stocks closed higher, helped by a recovery in healthcare stocks and gains in energy as investors await the beginning of earnings season. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 122 points after rising as much as 173 points, with Boeing contributing the most to the gains. Apple and Nike were the greatest drags on the index. The NASDAQ Composite rose 43 points to 4791, thanks to a jump in biotech stocks, and healthcare was the big winner in the S&P 500 on the day, helping that index come within 5 points of the psychologically key 2000 level.
And she says it's time for some big company earnings reports. What are investors expecting, Alexis?
They're not expecting much. In fact, they're expecting one of the worst earnings season in quite some time. They're looking for a number of multinationals to say that the slowdown in China has hurt the bottom line. We saw shares of Yum Brands stock tumble 19% after the owner of Pizza Hut and KFC said third quarter profit and sales missed expectations as what it called unexpected headwinds led to disappointing results out of China. Revenue from China represents 52% of Yum's total. Meanwhile, new skin shares plunged 24% after the cosmetics company lowered its third quarter revenue outlook because of disappointing sales in China during August and September, which the company said reflected the economic conditions in the country. Now, next week, Johnson & Johnson reports earnings. China accounted for 7% of that company's revenues over the last 12 months. And at J.P. Morgan Chase, about 3% of revenue comes from China. But the key to China's impact on earnings season could come next Wednesday. That's when Nike holds its investor day. And any hint that Greater China slowed since the end of August will not bode well for overall corporate earnings or the global stock market.
VOA business reporter Alexis Christophers in New York. Access to clean water is a problem for hundreds of millions of people around the world. Now, a scientist and chemical engineer in Tanzania is working to change that by creating an innovative water filter that makes dirty water safe. International Edition's Susan Yaki spoke about it with VOA reporter Deborah Block.
This thing, it's really amazing. It goes past what most water filters do. This particular water filter can absorb contaminants like copper, bacteria, viruses, and pesticides. And it uses nanotechnology, which is manipulating matter to control individual atoms and molecules so that you can filter the water in a way that most filters can't do.
Like, how does it work?
Well, for example, you take dirty water and buckets. It's connected to tubes that flow through the sand to trap debris and harmful bacteria. Then there's this layer of what's known as good bacteria on top of the sand that eats the microbes that cause disease. And then additional nanomaterials remove chemicals and other pollutants.
Is this something that somebody would use at home, or is this something that a company or a factory might use?
You can use it in all kinds of situations. For example, someone in their home who might fetch water from a local river that is quite polluted might use it because they can put it in their home. The setup can be easily done in a corner of their house. In the past, a lot of these people might have had to boil the water, which is very time-consuming to do. It doesn't necessarily clean everything, but this particular filter will, you know, even take out diseases like typhoid, which is utterly amazing.
Well, also, boiling the water sometimes means you have to use up fuel, burn wood or charcoal, and that creates a lot of pollution, too.
Yes, it certainly does. With this system, you're using, you know, sand and water and this incredible nanotechnology that, of course, we've only had in more recent years.
Well, it must be somewhat affordable. What's the cost of it?
Well, the cost of it is $140 US. For some people, that's too high. For other people, that's considered affordable. But the person that has developed this has received a U.S. government grant to help make his product more affordable and hopefully more available commercially. Right now, it's been being used in Tanzania, where Oscar Hilonga, who is the inventor of this, is from. But the hope is that this filter will just change the world and that many places that have dirty water will be able to use this filter and to use his system to somehow now not have the water problems and not have diseases, which would be an amazing feat.
VOA's Deborah Block speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Coming up, a visit with a sketch artist catching the bad guy. This is VOA. Police often face the problem of trying to find a crime suspect based on general descriptions that could fit hundreds of people in the vicinity of the crime. An artist can use information from witnesses to sketch a likeness that police can show the public through newspapers and television. VOA's Greg Flakis has details from Houston, Texas.
Guided by only witness descriptions, Lois Gibson can draw a picture of the person who committed a crime. Working with a few details, Gibson can produce a close but far from perfect likeness.
If it catches the person, it's perfect.
Gibson can relate to crime victims because when she was a 21-year-old dancer in Los Angeles, she herself was an attack victim. Her sketch of the attacker did not lead to an arrest, but many years later, the painful memory led her to work with the Houston Police Department.
The reason I wanted to do this is I just wanted to get one guy like that guy that did that to me.
Witnesses can find matches for specific features in this book, which helps Gibson compose a face, even if the witness is a 4-year-old boy who saw a man kill his parents.
I turned it around, and the 4-year-old got real mad, and he said, "Why did you draw a picture of that man? That means it looked like him." And everybody in the room started crying.
Through her teaching, Gibson encourages young artists to enter this field, not just to help cops catch bad guys, but to provide justice and comfort for crime victims. Greg Flakis, VOA News, Houston.
A new film looks at the life of the late Apple co-founder Steve Jobs, a mercurial innovator who helped to revolutionize the modern world. The movie features Oscar-winning writer Aaron Sorkin's take on the life of the man who made iPad, iPhone, and iMac part of the language forever. International Edition's David Byrd has more.
People often seem to have one of two opinions about Steve Jobs. Either they love him and think he was a genius, or they despise him as an abusive egomaniac. But Oscar winner Aaron Sorkin has walked between these two extremes with his treatment of the script of Steve Jobs.
What if the computer was a beautiful object? Something you want to look at and have in your home? And what if, instead of it being in the right hands, it was in everyone's hands?
We'd be talking about the most tectonic shift in the status quo since...
ever.
Sorkin worked off Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, but didn't want to do an episode-by-episode treatment of Jobs' life. He presents the audience with the Apple co-founder in three acts, in 1984, in 1988, and again in 1998. Sorkin says that presenting the story in three acts lets the audience glimpse some of the man behind the public persona.
The whole movie is just three scenes. All of them in real time. Real time, of course, means 30 minutes for you in the audience. It's the same as 30 minutes for a character on screen. And explore these points of conflict that Steve had in his life. And that way you get to know him. And they're all set backstage in the minutes leading up to one of his big product launches.
The first act is when Jobs is about to launch the Apple Macintosh. The second is in 1998, when Jobs has been forced out of Apple and has created a computer that will ultimately fail. The third act is in 1998, with him back at Apple ready to launch the iMac. Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender plays the title role and says that he had no problem with the way Sorkin decided to stage the story.
No, I mean, it was a luxury, a massive luxury, and a necessity, really, to have those 2 weeks in between each act. So we had the 2 weeks... Start Act 1, finished that, took 2 weeks rehearsal, and then same thing for Act 2, same thing for Act 3. It was a great help, you know, just in terms of dealing with the volume of lines.
Fassbender says he didn't try to find out too much about Steve Jobs outside of Sorkin's script.
This is not a biopic, it's a dramatization, and I just tried to, you know, honor the script and follow Danny's direction. And just, you know, also... full respect to Mr. Jobs, you know, honor the man himself.
Director Danny Boyle says he was impressed with Fassbender's characterization and discipline. Boyle says he never saw the actor look at a script or asked for a line. He just inhabited the character.
He's an actor. He's an uncompromising actor, really. So when the studio go, can he be a bit more, can I have a bit more likability in this scene? You're not going to, Michael's not going to listen to that. He is an intensely truthful and uncompromising actor. And there's something very Jobsian about that lack of compromise, that drive to the, you know, to the vision.
Kate Winslet plays Jobs' confidant Joanna Hoffman. Seth Rogen plays Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Jeff Daniels stars as John Sculley, the CEO of Apple from 1983 to 1993. Catherine Waterston plays Chris Ann Brennan, Jobs' high school girlfriend and the mother of his first child. Steve Jobs opens nationwide in U.S. theaters October 23rd. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In too many countries around the world, criminals have built great empires on laundered funds to infiltrate and corrupt government institutions. In this shadowy illegal economy, said David Luna of the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, traffickers and narcotics kingpins act as CEOs and venture capitalists while they build their empires of destruction. These illicit activities have taken over a significant chunk of the world economy. According to various international organizations, the illegal economy accounts for 8 to 15% of the world gross domestic product. And in many developing countries, it may account for higher percentages in their economies. The World Trade Organization estimates that the value of counterfeit and pirated goods alone is equivalent to some 7% of the world's merchandise. This darker side of global trade is thriving with hundreds of billions of dollars in illicit commerce that includes trafficking in narcotics, persons, and endangered wildlife, among other goods and commodities. Simply put, illicit trade is an obstacle to shared prosperity by breeding corruption and siphoning capital and human resources away from legitimate economic activity. The best way to combat illegal trade is through collective action. This includes strengthening cross-border cooperation to tackle illicit commerce and help communities to seize the benefits of open trade to achieve sustainable development and security. Country implementation of the WTO's Trade Facilitation Agreement will play a critical role in this process. The United States will continue to enhance international cooperation with key partners to combat the lethal nexus of organized crime, illicit trade, corruption, and money laundering, and to protect communities from the violence, harm, and exploitation brought about by transnational networks. The U.S. will do this by enhancing its efforts to break their corruptive power, attacking their financial underpinnings, following the money and stripping them of their illicit wealth, and severing their access to the financial system. At a time when global risks are growing and converging, the international community must come together and build its own network to stand up to and defeat the dark world of illicit trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.